starts on the three and knocks it down. Allen kicks it out. Battier tries again. It's good. Sam Battier. 2 for 2 from downtown. Battier. 3 for 3 from downtown. James open. Up top Chalmers. Battier for three.
Nation, you're listening to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thank you for subscribing on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on Himalaya. My name is David Ermil. It's my interview with Shane Battier. I reached out to the Miami Heat and asked if I could speak with Shane as part of the exploration of the best seasons and moments in Miami Heat history. But of course, talking to Shane, you always wind up going a little bit deeper than all that. And so while it does touch on the 2012-2013 NBA season, it was also important for me to kind of understand his perspective on why he chose the Miami Heat during the 2011 free agency, what it was like to join a team with so much hype and noise surrounding them, and of course, going into the details of the 27-game win streak and his part in all that, as well as Ray Allen's shot, the championship against the San Antonio Spurs, and then of course the end of his career. It's split up into a two-part interview. I'm airing this first part today on Thursday. Tomorrow's episode will be part two of the interview. Make sure you download them both. I think it's a fantastic conversation, and many thanks to the Miami Heat and their fantastic PR team for making this a reality. It was a joy to talk to Shane, and without any further ado, here's Shane Battier. He was Michigan's Mr. Basketball. He won the NCAA title with Duke University, and of course, he's a two-time NBA champion. It's an honor to have this guest on the show, the current Vice President of Basketball Development and Analytics for the Miami Heat, Mr. Shane Battier. Shane, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the podcast.
Hey, David, you have a captive audience today. So, like everybody else, practicing good physical distancing, and happy to film my afternoon on this podcast.
Excellent. Thank you. And how are you and your family doing through all this?
You know, we're making the most of it. Kids are doing great in virtual school, and we're safe and healthy, and just trying to do our part to physical distance ourselves and help flatten the curve. But, you know, we're safe and healthy, and we're grateful for that right now.
I could spend minutes talking about your individual accolades throughout your course of your career, but I'll get right into it and ask, where does playing congas with Jimmy Buffett on Margaritaville rank on your list of accomplishments?
Oh, man. That's up. Back in Detroit, my home, and I was in Comerica Park on stage with one of my main men, Jimmy Buffett. It's up there. And, like, I don't get nervous much. All right, but staring at, you know, 60,000 fans watching me try to play the bongos, I had a little bit of nerves going, so it was tough. that was an amazing night.
Yeah, it seemed like you were enjoying yourself, but you don't actually play the drums or anything like that, do you?
You know, as Jimmy said, he said, "Look, no one's going to hear if you mess up anyways. So just act like you know what you're doing." And that's what I did. So I don't think I ruined the song. If I did, I apologize to those people. But Jimmy gave me a lot of confidence before I went on stage.
I'm sure he did. Well, at the time that you announced your decision to join the Heat, you, of course, quoted Jimmy Buffett. And that was, I think, probably the only time in NBA history anybody's ever done that. Are you a parrot head by nature?
I am. I am a parrot head. My wife introduced me to Jimmy back when we were in high school. We dated, and they were always playing, you know, Margaritaville and songs you know by heart. And I'm like, who is this guy? Like, what's this guy about? And then they took me to a concert when we were in college. We dated, and I've been a Parrot head ever since. So I'm a huge Buffett. I've seen Buffett probably like 10 to 15 times already, and every time it's the greatest show. I love him. That's my guy.
Yeah, so I know he was. I think he was a part owner of the Heat, so it was a match made in heaven.
Yeah, and I've gotten to know him very well, and his daughter, and went to his daughter's wedding last year. So,
oh wow, okay.
He is a huge fan, and pretty knowledgeable, but he's so it's cool to know a guy who I admire on stage for his musical acumen.
Yeah, of course. So on to basketball. At the time you announced your decision, one of the things that you mentioned was that the lockout had given you perspective on what was most important. And the thing that you mentioned, of course, was prioritizing winning over other things. This is a direct quote from you. The lockout gave me lots of time to consider what was important to me at this stage of my life and career. Over the last week, I've played out every scenario in my head over and over. It always came back to the same thing for me, a winning role. Do you think you would have made that same decision if the lockout hadn't happened? Or did the lockout give you a kind of unique perspective on wanting to join a team like Miami?
I'd like to think that I would have made the choice to have a winning role on a team. You know, it's funny, like when players switch teams and they're free agents, they have a chance to go to a team. You know, every player wants, and they say they want to win. But when it gets down to it, they want to play and they want to win. And right. That was important to me. Look, I knew coming to Miami with the big three, have a chance, a really good chance to sort of cap off my NBA career with a championship. And it really came down to San Antonio and Miami. And obviously San Antonio was, you know, a fantastic team, and they had their own big three, which were formidable, as we found out in a few NBA finals battles. But there's something about Miami and the challenge and coming to a group that was so dynamic. And with the struggles they went through the year before I got here and losing to Dallas in the finals, you know, it was a great challenge for me. And to be honest with you, I don't know if I would have joined them if they had won the title against Dallas. That wouldn't have been as fun and as fulfilling to me as a professional chasing the ultimate goal. I think I probably would have gone to San Antonio if Miami had beaten Dallas that year. But as it was, they fell just short, and I felt that I was, you know, the perfect guy to bridge the gap and help them get it done. And so the rest is history, they say.
Well, what was your perspective like having played that year, 2010-2011 season? You were with Houston and then Memphis in a midseason trade. And, of course, you played Miami. You saw the news. You saw all the attention they were getting, the kind of the media hype that was built up around this team, and perhaps deservedly so. What was your perspective? Because I'm sure you had a unique one as a player watching this take place. I mean, you're a little removed, but you're also very much connected in a way that most of the fans were not.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, I played my entire career in the Western Conference, and so I didn't have as much of an intimate knowledge of the Heat as others did. Obviously, I knew Nick Arison, you know, very, very well for over 15, 16 years at that point, and so I was happy that he put together a team that was pretty good. But like everyone else, I wanted to beat him. I wanted to beat the super team, and you know, I'd known all those guys. I knew LeBron and Chris Bosh from USA Basketball, and obviously playing against them my entire career. But you know, they represented an amazing challenge because of their greatness, and I wanted to beat them. And I wasn't really rooting against them. I wasn't rooting for them, you know. I wanted every team to lose every game that I didn't play on. So that's sure. Just being a competitor. It was fascinating to see how they were received by the NBA fans, by the media, and they caught some heat, and you know, those are all, they're all tremendous guys. And so I think a lot of it was undeserved, but I think that was a position that they were not used to.
No, obviously not. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think most NBA fans have a rooting interest in their team or, you know, watching other teams fail. But from your perspective, it doesn't really matter to you. You're just playing against them. You want them all to lose. You want to win just like every other player in the NBA does. So that makes a lot of sense. And as far as your recruitment process was concerned, you had mentioned that the big three were relentless in their pursuit of you, that Pat Riley contacted you, that LeBron, Dwayne, and Chris all reached out to you at some point. What were some of the things that they said to try and recruit you? Obviously, having known you from USA Basketball, but also having played against you, what did they say that was appealing or interesting as far as the recruitment process?
Well, it started obviously with Pat and with Bo, and you know their message to me was, "You are a guy that we've tried to come after for you know so many years and try to trade for you." Didn't work out for whatever, but you know I epitomize what the Heat were all about: just the toughness, the work ethic, the winning mentality. Just do what it takes for the team, and that really made it with me. And that they sort of got that. And I played some amazing teams in Houston and in Memphis, but I never really thought that part of my game was truly like appreciated. And it was the first time someone had really complimented me on that, really since my days at Duke. And so that was the hook, line, and sinker they got me with. And actually, I wanted to talk to the big three because it was their show, and just wanted to get their perspective. And you know, look, we had a stacked team, bringing you know Mike Miller to the bench and Mario Homers and you know, really really good team. So like, I didn't want to come just to be a cheerleader. I wanted to come and play, and not that I want to clear it with the big three first, but it's always good to get their blessing. And all those guys had a lot of professional respect for what over my career, and they all said, "Look, you can help us win, and that's all that matters." And blessing, it was an easy choice.
So, did you go into this thinking that you kind of understood that you were going to be accepting a quote unquote role player role, that you were necessarily going to be a focal point of the team? And that was something that you were willing to accept because again, you were prioritizing winning over all else.
Well, you know, that ship had sailed after my rookie year in the NBA. I think I'm the only person ever to average a career high the rookie year and have their numbers decline the rest of their career. My career was about winning, and it wasn't about being marquee or having the commercials, although I had a lot of commercials in my shoe company. It was about doing what it takes to help the team win. And I made it better off being the quintessential player and a player that no matter what team he was on, that team performed well. And so, but, you know, I had a huge ego for what I did. And I didn't look at myself as less important. I thought of the things I did was extremely important. And the willingness to do things other than do was what kept me. And so, you know, I looked at it as the ultimate challenge. How can I meld my talent and my experience, you know, three of the greats, three of the greatest players of our generation. And so for me, that was the personal challenge within the challenge of trying to win a championship that was so compelling to me.
You kind of hinted at it earlier, and I think one of the things that a lot of my listeners are curious about is your decision to join the team in 2011. Obviously, having lost to the Mavericks, it put them in a unique position that I don't think a lot of people were expecting. But you weren't on that team. You joined Miami then, you know, a few months afterwards following the lockout. And there's this kind of hiatus in between, you know, obviously the finals loss and when basketball starts again. But once you start going to camp, what was it, at the end of November, I guess, once camp started in the shortened season, what was that process like? Was there still the loss of the Mavericks kind of hanging over this team, or was it more of a motivational fuel at that point?
Well, David, I got to tell you, like, I had never been around a team that was as hungry and had such a pronounced edge like that Heat team. The you know, the winter of 2011, that loss really, really impacted every one of those guys. It impacted the coaching staff, Pat Riley, Andy Ellisberg, the training staff. I mean, it was a gut punch. And so I walked in the first day of practice and I'm like, holy cow, these guys are hungry. And that was really the mindset from day one to the championship night at Oklahoma City. The hunger, the edge was so pronounced. And I think everyone felt that our first game against Dallas on Christmas Day after the lockout. And if you'd have seen our team back in the tunnel while the Mavs were getting their ring, it was a bunch of caged animals that they, you know, they just wanted to get out there and just punish Dallas. And we came out and we put them on them. And I left that arena and I was saying, we're winning this thing this year. Just because the hunger was so palpable.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think a lot of people probably expected a more significant drop off, even with a kind of incredible talent level. But knowing that they went back into that season, to the 11-12 shortened season, with much more intense focus and obviously resulting in a championship, that was probably a little unexpected. But one of the things that I'm curious about, and it's been widely publicized, maybe even to the point where it's become somewhat apocryphal, you know, Dwayne ceding, quote unquote, control the team to LeBron following the loss to the Mavericks. You joined that team in 2011, not knowing exactly what the dynamic was like before that. But did you get a sense, something palpable, of a transition being made from more of a LeBron-centric offense?
You know, not really. No, I read stories about that. And I know, you know, D has come out and said as much. But there was never really that dynamic in our locker room. Look, we had Hall of Fame players up and down the lineup. And we understood that, yes, at the time, LeBron was the greatest player in the world. And, you know, he was the alpha. So was Dwayne. And so was Chris. And so we knew we wouldn't go unless those guys were all playing at the highest level. Now, who, not for who, I don't think that was the case at all. We all looked at all those guys, and when they were playing at their highest level, we said, let's go. Right. Let's go. And so a little bit overstated, I think, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could agree. I never really saw any kind of huge transition myself, having watched those teams pretty closely, but I always thought it was kind of interesting how it was blown up so out of proportion. And maybe it was just a way of maybe Dwayne kind of trying to build a little bit more confidence in LeBron, who was still pretty young at that point. I mean, even though his talent level was off the charts and he was, as you said, the best player in the league, maybe needed a little bit more of a confidence boost. And you know, it's something that's been seen later on as far as LeBron's career arc. You know, maybe it's an issue that's been magnified since 2014, but it always seems like there's a transition to playing alongside a guy like LeBron. And it's an adjustment that's necessary in order to coexist and to thrive. You didn't find that to be the case as far back as 2011? Was there a difficult transition for you, or did you understand your role and knew how to fit it pretty closely?
I had the easiest job. Just stay out of the way and make an open shot. So for me, it wasn't that difficult. You know, I never ran pick and roll, and I wasn't a playmaker. And so literally my job was to fly around, throw my body around, get some loose balls, stay out of the way, create, you know, keep spacing and make a shot when I get it. And so, you know, for guys who may have had the ball in their hands a lot more, obviously, you know, D-Wade has spent his entire career on the ball, and CB had the ball in his hand a majority of the time in Toronto. You know, playing with other great players, yeah, there's a dance. There's a dance to understand, okay, when can I do my thing? When can you do your thing? And how can we do our thing together and make it all work? But you know, for me, I had a really, really, really simple job.
Yeah, I remember talking to Channing Frye when he joined the Cleveland Cavaliers a few years ago, and he basically echoed the same thing. He said, "My job is pretty easy. Get the fuck out of LeBron's way," I think was how he colorfully put it. So
yes.
I think that's pretty pretty shared sentiment there. What was LeBron like as a teammate? I think from my listener's perspective, so much has been stated about him being one of the most unique minds in the game. And of course, his ability to recall game-related minutia. Was that your experience, not having really played much with him together, aside from your experience in USA Basketball? What did you see from him up close as far as when you first joined the team and tried to kind of coexist alongside him?
Well, you know, LeBron was one of my favorite teammates. He just was a good guy. And I know there have been a lot of stories about him, but I enjoyed him from the standpoint that, like, look, here's arguably the most famous person in the entire world. And whenever he saw my son, Zeke, he would pick him up and, like, you know, mess his hair up. And he always addressed my wife by her name. And, like, look, as a teammate, like, those were maybe more important than the all-world basketball skills. And so, you know, when we used to host Battyoki different events for Take Charge Foundation, LeBron would always stand up and take the mic and say something nice about Heidi and I and the work that we're doing. And it was always active. And so, like, man, like, I'm never going to say a bad thing about that guy. He just was a tremendous teammate. And, he's one of the guys I'm going to tell my kids I was lucky to play with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you did play with a number of high-profile teammates throughout the course of your career, but what was that first year then of your experience in Miami like? I think there was a little bit of a change from the general public as far as welcoming the Miami Heat. I don't think it was the same kind of vitriol that was directed at them during the first year of the Big Three era, but what was your life like as far as that first season is concerned? Did you still get that kind of sense of widespread animosity, especially when you travel to other cities?
You know, not really. It was a whirlwind. Obviously, it was right after the lockout, so we had a bunch of games and it condensed period of time, and I just remember it just being a whirlwind. Right. And it, Miami is a wonderfully strange place to live, and you know, just culture, it took a lot getting to, and just living in a new city after living in the same place the last 5 years, bringing my family, kids, and I just remember just being overwhelmed, to be honest with you, and the energy of the team was unlike anything I had dealt with before. I mean, it was even more than what I dealt with when I played at Duke. And, there was an animosity. I think after losing to Dallas, public sentiment shift, and this became, LeBron almost became a sympathetic figure in a lot of ways, because they, his humanity sort of came through that loss.
Right.
And, you know, there's still some boos. We went like Boston and Cleveland, there were LeBron jerseys, a lot more, Dwayne jerseys there were on the road in previous years. And that was pretty stark. And, these guys talked about.
Yeah, I always thought that 2012-13 season was much more of a redemptive narrative arc for LeBron, because he had just won the championship in 2012. Of course, you all just won the championship. And then he had won gold that summer in with USA Basketball. And so I think, he had just won the MVP too. So he was, again, already widely acknowledged as the individual best player. He won all the team accolades as well. And it seemed like the sentiment had really started to change much more palpably. Did you get a sense of that as well, being a teammate and being in that same locker room with him?
You know, I think so. At the same time, we all knew that we had to win. And so it didn't really matter what the sentiment was.
Right.
We all knew if we didn't win the championship that year that they were probably going to end the Big Three experiment and go in a different direction. And so while, looking back at it, we can appreciate the public sentiment and people cheering for our team at that point. We're in the middle of the mixer trying to get it done. So people right. wouldn't leave us alone.
But it's interesting, though, that I think maybe a lot of media and perhaps maybe even your more outlandish media types were already clamoring for the breakup of the Big Three, even in, following the loss of the Mavericks in 2011. But even, going through that whole season, was that something that was palpable? Was that something that, you aren't necessarily going to talk about it, but it's something that players were acutely aware of in your perspective?
Well, look, I was used to that sort of scrutiny when I was at Duke. Because people love to see Duke play and see Duke lose.
Right.
And what I used to tell people is, look, there's only two stories in the first 5 minutes of SportsCenter, all right, when Duke wins and when Duke loses. Either way, you know what happens, you know, which is I can't say your school. And so that was always my comeback. So I was used to, we called it the noise. And you had to understand at that point, look, there's always a story to be had. And if there is a perceived somewhere or that people will try to make themselves try to that crack. So, we turned the noise off. It didn't, the world thought of our team, what the dynamics were. All that mattered was that we trusted each other. We did what we were supposed to. And we kept our eyes on the prize, and that was the message from Pat Riley. That was the message from Spoelstra, and that's what we. And so we knew, every missed shot at the end of a game where we lost, or a bump with a coach, or a look away from a high five. It's going to be scrutinized, and we all sort of laughed at it, and knew that it was inevitable with that sort of team, but it didn't matter in the grand scheme of things.
So you go through that whole season, you have some hard-fought playoff battles, but eventually you wind up beating Oklahoma City for the title, and you had a significant role in that. What was your takeaway from that experience? You won a championship at the collegiate level, but now having gone through this long career as a role player and by your own admission, and then to go through and play a significant role in helping to secure an NBA title, was there a sense of relief from not just, guys like LeBron who maybe had a much more intensely applied microscope being focused on them, but for you as well as a longtime NBA veteran?
I would say relief is the wrong word. I was just really happy. I was really happy for our group. It's really, really hard to win an NBA championship. And before that, I'd only been out of the first round once in my entire career. And so I didn't know what it took to win a championship. I didn't understand what a playoff grind was really all about. And we had some really good teams in Memphis and Houston, but they were very short. And to go through, 2 months of playoffs, it's just physically and mentally just grind. And when you get to the other side of it, you're just exhausted mentally because everything you put into it. And so relief wasn't the right word. It was just really joy. Yeah. And you understand what it means to be a champion. I know it sounds weird, but like you get it, and you appreciate people who've done it before you and sacrifices they made. And it's sort of like a secret boys club that if you haven't done it, you don't know what it's about. And so you can sort of give the secret handshake and the secret wink because it's the tough thing to do in team professional sports.
So that's all for part one. As I mentioned before at the start of the show, part two will air in just a few hours. Make sure you download both those episodes. Stay safe. Thank you so much for listening and for supporting. You can always reach out to me via Twitter or at email at lockedonheat@gmail.com. I'm David Romero. Thank you as always for your support.